two engineers start operating an overseas cable on the North Sea island of Borkum and open direct telegraph communications to New York. 36 men in the Zum Mariengarten restaurant in Leipzig found the German Football Association. 47 million visitors to the World Fair in Paris marvel at the diesel engine, the sound film, and the escalator. The year is 1900.
The construction site was on the Hoppenlaustrasse, and with the help of a mortgage, I was able to build number 11 on this street, which I built in cut stone and brick with beams and ceilings of reinforced concrete.
It was the first building in Württemberg, or in Stuttgart, the sources don't agree, built using reinforced concrete. This material had been developed by a Frenchman, Joseph Monnier, a gardener looking for a way to make inexpensive, durable flower pots. After much experimentation, he came up with the idea of using cement, with wire mesh worked into it for stability.
At the new factory in Stuttgart, not just the building materials were pioneering. Some of the owner's priorities were also virtually unheard of. For example, the workplace was designed so that it would not be harmful for the associates' health. He insisted on plenty of air and light, which at the time was anything but standard practice. In this phase of industrialization, also known as monopoly or finance capitalism, most factory owners were chiefly concerned with turning a profit, not with the workers or their well-being.
Consider how very essential it is, even in the strictest commercial sense, whether a factory labourer works in clean, dust-free air, which is neither too cold nor too hot. His performance is directly linked to the quality of the air and the light.
Bosch's popularity as an employer and the success of his company proved him right. The new building was designed for 200 workplaces. When they moved in, the number of staff totaled 45. 3 years later, the premises were already bursting at the seams, and 261 associates were busy at the workbenches.
A total of 10,000 magneto-ignition devices were produced before the move to the new factory. 5 years later, the 100,000th Bosch ignition device was assembled, and what Bosch had always intended to prevent had happened after all: specialization. This was all due to the steadily progressing development of the automobile. No longer a luxury toy, it was becoming a more and more practical means of transporting people and goods. Cars were growing ever more common, and new car makers were appearing on the market. Presto, Protos, Fiat, Skoda, Opel, Horch.
All these cars had one thing in common. Their speed was largely dependent on the smooth functioning of the ignition spark in the engine's combustion chamber.
In 1895, 9 years after the first test runs in Mannheim and Cannstatt, the fastest cars were hitting a good 24 kilometres an hour.
The early one-cylinder models were soon replaced by four cylinders, which also needed to be coordinated with the ignition system. In 1901, General Consul Jelinek's Mercedes car reached a breathtaking 75 kilometres per hour. 3 years later, an eight-cylinder hit 156.
At speeds like this, even the Bosch low-voltage ignition device reached its limits, and Robert Bosch charged his head engineer, Gottlob Honnold, with improving it. The ideal solution, he felt, would be to eliminate the brake spark rodding, as it required quite a lot of maintenance and was prone to breakdown. It was also difficult to manufacture, because it had to be redesigned for every engine individually.
The goal was to find a solution which produced a hot spark of relatively long duration with fixed electrodes.
In the device which had been selling so successfully thus far, The ignition spark was triggered by a mechanical break in an electric circuit at two movable contacts within the cylinder. Gottlob Honnold tried out a new method, in which a spark was discharged between two electrodes under high voltage. Based on this principle, he developed the high-voltage magneto and the spark plug.
This was the breakthrough, and signalled the start of the company's meteoric rise to a new undreamed-of dimension. While it had taken 20 years to sell the first 100,000 ignition systems, just six went by before the 1 millionth was sold, this time a high-voltage one.
But the German market alone couldn't absorb these quantities, nor could all of Europe. England and France had long since been supplied in partnership with Frederick Sims. But now, drivers in Milan, Stockholm, Brussels, Bucharest, Moscow, Johannesburg, Buenos Aires and Melbourne, and soon also in Shanghai, Yokohama, Athens, Rio, Constantinople and Cairo, were all demanding spark plugs and accessories made by Bosch.
International offices were set up according to one of two systems. Either import and trade licenses were granted to local companies, or the Bosch company set up its own sales outlets, branches and service stations. The huge success was not, however, without its downsides. The partnership with Frederick Sims, which had been strained for some time, rapidly took a turn for the worse.
He sought ways to force others to buy from him, so as to prey upon them. Under his leadership, it was impossible to establish substantial operations, especially in England.
Early letters began, "Dear Bob." Now they were headed, "Dear Sir." Robert Bosch's unease grew as he realised that the contracts he had signed with Sims in the early days, when he was still fairly inexperienced, put him at a disadvantage.
I felt oppressed by the fact that Sims should be in a position to take over the English patents at any time and to use his status as a majority shareholder to manufacture products himself in France.
The situation was, in fact, even more complicated than that. Sims also held the rights for America, but was not active there, even though the market was clearly ready. Robert Bosch decided to disassociate himself from Sims.
It proved difficult to dissolve the contracts. The parties struggled to find the right wording and got caught up in details. All of a sudden, Sims offered to buy everything, the entire business, for 5 million German marks.
But we failed to reach agreement because Sims didn't want to pay the 5 million German marks in cash. Instead, he wanted to keep me as a shareholder in his company.
It would not, however, have been a good idea to exchange the entire Bosch business for Sims' shares. Robert Bosch would then have been dependent on a businessman he no longer trusted, and with good reason, as would soon become clear.
An audit revealed that Sims had somehow forgotten to pay the license fees he owed on spark plugs that had been manufactured in England. And when selling Bosch consignment stock in France, he had made a calculation error of 100,000 French francs in his favour.
That was it. Robert Bosch had run out of patience. He knew he needed to break with Sims as quickly as possible and make sure his former partner had no more opportunities for trickery. In the end, Bosch was successful on this front.
Robert Bosch was able to disassociate himself from Sims. The settlement that followed was fair, and the matter was closed. Bosch was glad to have bought his way out of all his contracts with Sims. Now he could finally conduct business abroad according to his own principles.
I have always acted according to the principle that I would rather lose money than trust. The integrity of my promises, the belief in the value of my products and in my word of honour have always had a higher priority for me than a passing profit.
Bosch could now finally begin planning for the American market, where the Ford Motor Company in Michigan was building cars which were so inexpensive that many people could afford one. Robert Bosch dubbed the boom that followed Car Mania, meant in an entirely positive sense. The first business trip to the USA was undertaken by one of Bosch's directors and was intended as the first step towards developing business there. As it turned out, the company took the new world by storm. Within a few weeks, orders had come in totaling over $1 million, and an office of the Bosch Magneto Company was opened in New York, on the corner of Broadway and 66th Street.
Business was running so well that orders could no longer be filled just with overtime. Associates were now working 2 8-hour shifts in Stuttgart. 19 years after its founding, the company employed over 500 people.
All over the world, the number of cars on the roads was now skyrocketing. Every car had an engine, and every engine needed an ignition system. The best ignition system in the world was made by Bosch. Yet the company's founder was uneasy. Even now, or especially now, during this heady period of success, he was still plagued by an old worry.
My product is a flash in the pan. One day an invention will come along to make my ignition systems obsolete. And how will I employ my staff then?
Traffic was increasing and people were more mobile, but it was also creating hazards. The authorities issued the first regulations.
Both sides of an automobile are to be fitted with brightly burning lanterns made of white glass. It must be ensured that these lanterns project light onto the street in such a way that the driver will be able to see the street at least 20 meters in front of the vehicle. It is forbidden to install overly bright headlights.
Car makers didn't pay much attention to this at first. They were concerned with the chassis, engine and frame, not with what were considered minor matters. They experimented, half-heartedly at first, with candles in draft-proof lanterns, later with petroleum lamps and acetylene or carbide lamps. None of them worked very well. The light was too faint, and they were too complicated to operate. And the first attempts at using light bulbs failed. They didn't last long enough.
Robert Bosch and his engineers recognised a challenge worth taking on, and Gottlob Honnold, the successful designer of the high-voltage magneto, returned once again to his experimental workshop. Two entirely separate demands awaited him: designing headlights that performed adequately and powering them.
The order of the day? Experiments with light bulbs and filaments that would stand up to the job. Trials with surface curvature and ribbed lamp glass to illuminate the side of the road as well as the centre. Tests of systems for changing the bulbs easily without having to take apart the entire lamp. And on top of that, the mammoth task of creating the parabolic metal reflector that would allow the light to be focused with precision.
At the same time, they were trying to come up with a way of generating electricity while driving. Nothing of this kind had existed before, but it had to be invented because the lights wouldn't stay lit unless electricity was constantly available. What emerged from these efforts was the Bosch automotive lighting system, with headlights, a generator, a regulator, and a battery. It could be installed in any car, of course in the usual Bosch quality, and was more durable, more reliable, and quite simply better than anything the competition had to offer.
The new product did more than just alleviate Bosch's worry of being too dependent on a single product. It also showed Bosch and his engineers what lay ahead. There were plenty of ways of improving the automobile. For example, what if an electric starter could be used instead of a manual crank? Bosch began evolving into a multifaceted supplier to the automotive industry.
By 1913, Robert Bosch was 52 years old and employed 11,000 people. At this time, it became apparent that his son, who was one day supposed to take over the business, was fighting a losing battle against illness, multiple sclerosis. Bosch thus had a new worry. What would happen to the company if he himself fell ill or died?
Robert Bosch and his closest executives contemplated establishing a stock corporation. This move was designed to guarantee a degree of control for the people who had helped build the business and whom he trusted at a time when he himself was no longer able.
Es muss denn das Schwert nun entscheiden. Mitten im Frieden überfällt uns der Feind.
This plan, like all other activities, was shattered by an event on the international stage. On August 1, 1914, Germany, as an ally of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, declared war on Russia.
Robert Bosch was in no way in favour of this conflict, but it was immediately clear to him that the coming horrors would demand substantial social commitment. He had no hesitation in conferring a new, but still unoccupied, factory building for use as a military hospital. And the personal system of donations he had started years before would run to a small fortune during the course of this war.
International business, which by now accounted for 88% of total sales, collapsed almost completely. Overnight, countries the company was exporting to became enemies, and Bosch could no longer ship to them. This was the first war in human history in which motorized vehicles would prove crucial. Exports to neutral countries were also banned because the government feared the enemy would turn to these markets to get the Bosch ignition systems that were still in such demand.
Still, the company and staff continued to grow. The state and the military converted most of the company to arms production and placed vast orders. But the resulting profits did not make its founder happy.
At the end of 1916, I made the decision to channel my war gains into a foundation for the construction of the Neckar Canal, and also for a homeopathic hospital association and an association for the advancement of gifted children.
The war years were a terrible time for him. Time and again he was notified that employees of his had lost their lives on the front. At the same time, he was forced to watch his son's illness advancing. All this distress took its toll on his health. The option of establishing a stock corporation was discussed again, and in 1917, when he was 56 years old, finally carried out. He sold 49% of his shares to the directors. He wasn't entirely happy with this arrangement, but for the time being, it would have to do.
In the autumn of 1918, the scenario Bosch had been anticipating for some time finally became reality. The war was lost. The victorious foes, it was feared, would hardly be inclined to show mercy.
Robert Bosch was left contemplating the ruins of his life's work. What would become of the traditional, respectable, self-built business of ignition systems, lighting systems and starters? What had the years of armed struggle done to his business partners, the trading offices and production facilities in other parts of the world? And how would others see him? As a despised enemy? How would he be received? If he were received at all?